Bridget Jones ist zurück.
Ich habe dich bei Tinder angemeldet.
Was?
Bridget Jones. Verrückt nach ihm. Jetzt zu Hause erleben, kaufen oder leihen. Erhältlich bei Amazon Prime Video, Apple TV und im Sky Store. Auch im Kino.
Es ist Zeit zu leben.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. How's everybody doing? Hey, you know what? It's early, huh? Put the drink down. Think about it, okay? Just take it easy, will you? Could you just put the bong down for a second? Could you not vape at 10 in the morning? Could you not? How are you still awake? I'm talking to the people that are struggling with addiction, alcoholism, drugs, whatever your thing is. Maybe you've been up all night with the porn. I don't know. But if you're struggling and you want to stop, but you just can't because it's like it's 6 a.m. and you're still cutting lines. Come on. Enough already. It doesn't age well. It doesn't get any different. It doesn't get any better. It's going to be the same thing over and over again. Whatever it is that you are compulsively doing on a daily basis to alter your perception or feel better or reward yourself somehow, that's all lost after the first hour or two. And then it's just a chase, man. It's just a chase. Maybe it's distracting you. Maybe it's making you feel well. But God, let's reel it in, huh? What do I got to tell you? Go to a meeting. Don't worry about the God part. Just go. Just do something. Come on, man. Life is short enough the way it is. And I'm telling you, it ain't going to change if you keep doing it. Just not. It's going to be the same. All right. Yeah, that's enough. Now I'm going to talk to the other people. How's everyone else doing? How's the bike ride? Good. How's the exercise going? Good. Good. How's the dog walking? Say hi to your doggy for me. Terrific. You okay at work there? You set up. You got your coffee and everything. How's the painting? How's the shoemaking? How's the silversmithing? What's happening? You working with clay? Is it clay? Hey, Dimension, I'm Mark Maron. Dimension today, no, I didn't. I know I didn't because I know exactly what I've been talking about. Today on the show, Jay Leno came over. He was in a very shiny Corvair. I don't know what year it is, but those are always interesting cars to see around. It was red. It was beautifully painted, nicely done. A Corvair, I don't know when they made those, probably in the mid to late 60s. I'm guessing the Corvair was sort of not a Corvette. I think it was made by Chevy. I'm not a car guy. So that's not what we were talking about, me and Jay. Not much anyways. I did buy a car though. I bought a new car. But I guess there's a lot to talk about. Saturday, November 10th at 7:30 p.m., I will be playing the Beacon Theater as part of the New York Comedy Festival. Pre-sale tickets go on sale this Wednesday, August 8th at 11 a.m. Eastern through Sunday, August 12th at 10 p.m. Get them at nycomedyfestival.com. The pre-sale code is TNYCF. The general on sale date is Monday, August 13th at 10 a.m. Eastern. And I've got other dates coming up. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour. I'm going to Bloomington, Indiana. I'm going to Denver, Colorado. I'm going to Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'm going to Phoenix for a night. But New York Comedy Festival, Beacon Theater, very exciting. It's one of the reasons I've been going out and hitting the clubs, doing several shows in a row, hammering it out, finding the through lines, riffing it so I can get it all into one piece in my mind before the big show in November. So that's why I was in Salt Lake City. Aside from, I go there once a year or so, I believe. I've been to Wise Guys many times in different locations. The downtown location seems to have stuck. It's an odd room, but it's a good room, and we had a good time. It's always a little tweaky for me in Salt Lake City. I really do want to thank the people for coming out because I really feel that everybody that I could possibly draw comes out to see me in Salt Lake City. That's about 1,000 people. Did four shows. I think the room seats 250 and change. But there's something about the weird sort of mystical and cultural balance of Salt Lake City that is very provocative to me. I'm compulsively interested in kind of the religious. And I'm not always cynical. I'm not always negative. But the Mormons are a very specific bunch. And it's just interesting to be in that city, knowing that it's all there, knowing it was built by them, knowing that it's, you know, you can go to the place where the thing happened and where things do happen. And then there's, you know, it extends out into who knows what. They know. But it's just a mysterious thing. And then there's the people that aren't that. And then there's the people that used to be that. And then there's the 100-degree heat. And then there's the altitude. And I just find myself wandering the sterile streets of downtown Salt Lake City, almost in a kind of in-movement meditation. But I do get tripped out. Like, even flying in, you know, you fly into Salt Lake, you look out. On one side, it's beautiful mountains. On the other side, there's I really believe it's drying up. The Great Salt Lake is drying up. And then there's all these weird swampy-looking tide pools in the middle of the desert with, I don't know, some sort of very persistent algae. The persistent green in the middle of the desert in the salt tide pools near the Salt Lake. It's definitely post-apocalyptic. It almost looks like... It looks like the last water source on Earth. It looks like that's the only water left on Earth, and there's a roaming crew of humans in just like beat up, you know, maybe not quite road warrior, but maybe sort of more Bedouin with modern pieces of appliances wandering. And the Great Salt Lake looks like the water they come upon. You know, and they're so relieved that they finally found it, and then they taste it, and they're like, oh, fuck, too salty. And that's the way it ends. That's the way that tale ends. But point being, I tend to get pretty far out there, and I'm glad that the audiences were supportive, because that second show Saturday, that was trippy. That was trippy, and I enjoyed being there. So thank you for having me, Salt Lake. Although I'm not a sanctioned Mormon act, I don't believe that... The ones that came minded. One person tweeted at me that my current Mic Pence bit went a little too far and ruined he and his wife's evening. And I kind of apologize for that. And maybe I should have warned you, but there's really no way to warn anybody about that bit. I don't know where it came from. It's some old school kind of like Rabelaisian filth that I've hammered the vice president into. It's a piece, man. It's a piece, and I understand, and I try to explain how, you know, I understand that it could be offensive, and I try to negotiate that, because I do like to be a bit diplomatic in these things. So Jay Leno, I didn't think I'd be talking to him. I just didn't assume it would ever happen. You know, it didn't happen back when things were lively for Jay in both the good and the bad ways. But it didn't happen. It just never came up. I mean, many of you who listen to the show, you know that I did the Tonight Show towards the end of the Tonight Show. I think it was for the first season of GLOW, maybe the last season of Marin. I don't know. But he invited me. I decided to do it. I'd never done the Tonight Show. I didn't know if the Tonight Show was going to be in existence anymore. And I don't need to make excuses. I did Jay Leno's Tonight Show to see what it would be like. And it was odd, because Jay came into my dressing room before the spot. He was in his Canadian tuxedo as usual, and he kind of talked to me for like a half hour about how he thought I didn't like him, how he thought I was a Conan guy, how he assumed that, you know, that I just didn't want to do the show and whatnot. But his point really was like, he went out of his way to say, you're a comic, I'm a comic, we're comics, right? Yes, we are. We're comics. At heart, we are comics. That is what we are made of. Comedians are of a certain cut of a certain cloth, especially the lifers. Yeah, and I'm certainly a lifer, as is Jay. So, whatever else you do, you're a comic. And people know who you are. I mean, and I'm saying comics, you know who I'm talking about. And, you know, I might be talking about you. There are people that are passing through, and then there are lifers. So, point being, what I got out of that conversation was that Jay... I don't know if I would say upset, but he knew that most of the comics had pulled away in terms of their respect for him for whatever reason. And I know what the reasons are. And there's been a few over time. And so when I got the opportunity to have Jay on the show, I thought that, well, I don't have anything to lose. And I have respect in place for him, but I also have questions about the choices he made, and maybe he'll talk about it. And that's what I set out to do with this interview, because When I was younger, Jay Leno was one of the funniest guys alive. I mean, when I was a kid in my teens, watching the daytime shows after school, Merv Griffin, Mike Douglas, whatever the hell it was, you know, Jay would be there and he would be funny. And when I went at the original Letterman show, which I started watching at the beginning in college, Jay was pretty much on 4 or 5 times a year at least, and he was funny. He was a great comedian. And then I remember in college, I came out to L.A. one summer with my friend Steve Brill after maybe it's probably after sophomore year. We went to the Improv. I saw Jay Leno and he was fucking funny. And I remembered a joke he did kind of halfway almost. And it's very interesting. You'll listen in the interview. I mean, that had to have been 1984, 83. And I reminded him of the joke that I could barely remember, though I remember the punchline. He remembered the joke. Got a mind like a steel trap, that guy. But really what I wanted to talk about is that I think the first shift in the comedian's perception of Jay was when he took The Tonight Show and what he did with it. You know, it went from Johnny, who we all thought was a class act. It was really, Johnny Carson was very important to comics. He was very important to Jay. And there was like, you know, the whole fight between Letterman and Jay. Johnny thought that Letterman should get it. And then there was, you know, whatever the story is, you know the story. It's available. It's in a book about what went on between Jay and Dave and how Jay got the show over Dave. And, you know, that was a sticking point because I was a Dave guy, thought Dave deserved it. He'd earned it. He'd worked for it. So that was the first shot for me. And I can't assume to know what other comics thought. But for me, being a Dave guy, but loving Jay as a comedian, thought Dave deserved The Tonight Show. And Jay took The Tonight Show. And what was once a classy, though schmaltzy outlet or show, you know, he made into a circus, you know, and there I just remember being very critical of it at the time. And, you know, and just like him touching the audience and running around, it just like it just felt like it went just a little low rent in a way, or just mediocre, or whatever. So then you got to deal with Jay hosting this show that you thought Dave should have gotten. And then Jay's, you know, processing jokes. He's got to do monologues. So he's not doing, you know, the type of material that he necessarily did as a solo act. He's churning through a lot of jokes. They're okay. He doesn't seem to quite fit the suit or the screen for a few years. But that was the first couple of hits, is that we felt like he took the show from Dave. Then he was on the show and then he sort of degraded himself in the show in terms of the content being a little lowbrow, or I guess that's the word. And that was a big hit. And, you know, and then a lot of us were like, well, I don't know, man. And then Bill Hicks did a sort of, you know, seminal, is that the right word, bit about Jay selling out on the Doritos commercials. And you know, we were all, you know, a lot of us were Bill Hicks people. And, you know, Bill Hicks was a sort of enlightened, a genius, lyrical kind of joke puncher, you know, really, you know, it had a lot of guts and had a lot of insight and really could nail it in a way that no one else could. And he nailed Jay, and that stuck. That stuck with a lot of comics, you know. Then there's a second wave of this, you know, the Conan debacle. So I imagine some of you people who aren't my age or don't remember those earlier sort of Jay Leno events, you remember the Conan event. Conan was contracted to begin The Tonight Show. And Jay was contracted to leave it. So it seems that he didn't necessarily want to leave, but certainly that was what the paperwork said that he had to do. And Conan went and got his job. And he got on The Tonight Show and he did Conan. He did the Conan thing. Now, Conan's another guy, been very good to me. Since the mid-90s, Conan used to, when throughout the New York run of that show, Conan put me on 3 or 4 times a year as a panel guest, which was my dream, because I wanted to be like Jay was on Dave. I wanted to be like Richard Lewis was on Dave. I wanted to be like George Miller was on Dave. I wanted to be a guy that sat down and had that relationship with the host. And Conan did that for me over and over again. I owe a great deal to Conan in terms of, you know, giving me some exposure. It didn't really amount to ticket sales, but that was probably my fault over those years, clearly. But nonetheless, you know, I was excited for Conan to get The Tonight Show, and he got it. The issue with Jay at that point was that Tonight Show was sort of tanking with Conan. The numbers weren't great. They weren't picking up. So they panicked, and Zucker, I guess it was, wanted to, you know, push The Tonight Show up to midnight and, you know, have Jay do an hour or whatever it was. Jay was back in it. Jimmy Kimmel spoke out against it. You know, many of us were sort of flabbergasted and upset by the whole thing, like give the guy a chance. But eventually, Conan resigned, was pushed out, as opposed to go do the Tonight Show at midnight, and Jay came back and was there for however many years that was. So that was really the strike three in terms of the comic or certain comics' respect for him, the certain parts of the community. Not everybody, but this is just my recalling of it. So these were, you know, the transgressions or whatever they were, the things that chipped away, you know, at Jay's stature as the great comic that he once was, because he was. The 80s, that was the early 80s, man, you know. He was the fucking guy. Good jokes. And he's out there doing it still, just doing jokes and driving cars around. So I took the opportunity to talk to him, and I'm glad I did, and you'll hear that in a second. I do need to tell you that he's got a new show, Jay Leno's Garage. It airs Thursday nights at 10 p.m. on CNBC. You can also watch full episodes at CNBC.com and on YouTube. And it was interesting. It was interesting to be sitting in here with Jay Leno. This is comic stuff, man. So this is me and Jay.
Bridget
Jones.
Bridget ist zurück.
Hattest du Sex?
Bridget Jones, verrückt nach ihm. Jetzt zu Hause erleben, kaufen oder leihen. Erhältlich bei Amazon Prime Video, Apple TV und im Sky Store. Auch im Kino.
Ja, ich hatte Sex. Und es war fantastisch.
Hey. How you feeling, Jay?
Good. I feel really good.
You do? What have you been doing? What are you like?
Nothing. I'm on the road a lot. I do that Jay Leno's Garage show.
We got
an Emmy nomination this week, so that's good.
That's exciting.
Yeah, we do 52 of those shows on YouTube, and then we do 16 1 hours on CNBC.
And what's the structure like? How is it different than the other guy's car show? Seinfeld's car show.
Well, Jerry's is more talking with comedians in cars. Mars, we feature more on the cars.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. On the TV show on CNBC, the YouTube show is more technical.
Yeah.
The CNBC show, we do stunts, crash cars, roll cars, do all kinds of stuff.
So you're working with stunt people, working with car experts.
Kind of stuff, yeah.
Blowing shit up sometimes.
Blowing shit up, yeah, anything like that. Yeah.
But you don't ruin any nice cars, though, do you?
No, not really.
How many cars do you have now?
Oh, man, you sound like my wife.
Hey, really?
There's about 186 cars, about 163 motorcycles.
You keep a count. You know exactly how
I know
many.
Exactly. That's how you do it.
But do you, like, spend the whole day down there with them? Or what do you, I mean, do you, like...
You know, it's what I like to do. I grew up in a rural area, and you always had to fix something, lawnmowers and old motorcycles. And, you know, when we were 12, we had an old Renault 4CV. We used to drive around the backyard. My mom would watch us through the window.
Yeah.
You know, now, of course, they call child services and your parents are taken away. But back then, you know, they allowed kids to have a certain amount of responsibility.
But where was that? That was in Andover?
Andover, Mass, yeah.
I guess it is kind of rural, huh?
It was then. Now it's like, that was before Route 93 went in. It used to take 45 minutes an hour to get there. Now it's 20 minutes. So now it's like a bedroom community. You know, you got the $5 chocolate chip cookie and the Starbucks.
Right. And, you grew up the whole time there? Like, it was your whole childhood?
Well, I was born in New York, lived there till I was 9, then we moved to Massachusetts. It's funny, I only lived in New England 10 years, 9 to 19, but it seems like 80% of my life.
It feels like you got the accent anyways, isn't it? I mean,
I didn't get as bad as some. You know, I didn't get that, you know. To me, the funniest scene in any movie is in, the first Ted.
Yeah.
You know, and they show, it takes place in Boston, and you see this beautiful woman walk in.
Yeah.
She's got some kind of supermodel body.
Right.
You know, whatever the height of fashion and tasteful clothes are.
Yeah.
She got this, and she's beautiful with the high cheekbones. The guy's saying, what are you fucking retard? You fucking and it's just that Boston action. It just killed. I literally fell out of my chair. It really made me. What are you fucking asshole? hilarious.
Well, you know, being like having spent time there because I started doing comedy there too, is like there's nothing like it. There's nothing like the people are all pretty good people, but it's pretty.
It's all
rough.
Good people, but it's weird because it's the only town that's liberal and racist.
Well, yeah, because of the colleges, and then you get. get a little outside of Boston, and it's kind of
well. It's funny because you have MIT, Harvard on this end, and the other end you got Southie, and so you have this intellectual anti-intellectual clash
all
the time.
Yeah,
and you have it's not that they're dumb. I don't mean dumb people. It's just people that live by their hands, that
hard
live by
people.
Their wits, that work for a living versus people who think for a living.
Yeah.
And then not saying one is better than the other. I'm not saying, oh, people, that. I don't mean it that way. It's just, it's, you know, the analogy to me is in the Rodney Dangerfield movie.
Yeah.
I think it's Back to School.
Yeah.
Where the professor's teaching how do you build a building.
Yeah.
And then Rodney goes, yeah, but then you got the union guy. You got to slip him $100. And how about the other guy? And when the other guy comes, and, you know, Rodney's got all the ways to get the real way to get it done. You know, and that's Boston.
And that's the beat where all the kids turn to him and start taking notes.
Yeah, that's the funniest thing. Oh, yeah, what do you do when the union rep comes? And you got to slip him $1,000, you know, blah, blah, blah. Very funny.
Yeah, do you remember him? Did you know him?
I love Rodney. You know.
You know what's weird, Jay, is that, like, in retrospect, he doesn't get the respect he deserves. Like, I mean, like, he, you know, people talk about him, but, you know, he should be always talked about as one of the greats.
He is one of the greats.
Yeah.
I remember the dumbest review ever. Rodney was at the Comedy Store once in the main room.
Yeah.
And the LA Times reviewer was obviously somebody new, and the reviewer said, Mr. Dangerfield has an annoying habit of constantly touching his tie and moving it. You know, why doesn't he get a shirt that he missed the whole point of it.
When was that? The 70s?
Oh, yeah, 70s, early 80s. I'll tell you my favorite Rodney story.
Yeah.
Rodney, well, first time, Rodney was on The Tonight Show, and he's doing his act. And
with you or with Johnny?
With me.
Oh, yeah.
Because that was I used to love him with Johnny.
Yeah.
Because you just, Johnny would just repeat one word.
Yeah.
I went to the store the other day. Oh, I tell you, Dana, and the guy there. And what happened? And so whenever Rodney would call me, I love to do that. I love to go, things are going wrong. Not good at all. Not good. Oh, not good at all. Yeah. And you just repeat the last two words that he said. You know, so anyway, he's doing his act, and I notice he twitches.
Yeah.
And I go, well, that's not part of it, you know.
Yeah.
And I called Debbie, my producer, over, and I said, look, I don't want to panic anybody. I think Rodney's having a stroke.
Really?
You know? I said, just call paramedics. Can they get home? Okay. So I called paramedics, and Rodney sits down, and he's a little out of breath, and looks, he's okay.
Yeah.
But he just looked a little off. He's, you know that millisecond, it's amount of time, if you're a comic, you can't measure it, but you know it's just off.
Right.
You know? So then they come in and they say, Rodney, you go, oh, I'm fine, I tell you, you know. No, he did have a stroke. They took him to the hospital.
Really?
Yeah, okay. So then Joan and I got to be good friends after that. That's his wife. And then years later, when Rodney was in a coma in the hospital, I went to see him.
Yeah.
And it was right before he died.
Yeah.
And Joan said, Jay, Rodney can't speak or say anything, but I think he can hear you. I said, okay, how you doing, Rodney? You know, blah, 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 I love your man, all that kind of stuff. So she says to me, Rodney, if Jay, put your finger in Rodney's hand.
Yeah.
She goes, Rodney, if you know it's Jay, squeeze his finger. So he's squeezing my finger, and I go, Rodney, that's not my finger. And he twitched, and she said, I think he's trying to laugh. And it really made me feel good that I made Rodney laugh before he did. I mean, it really touched me that he reacted that way, you know? So it was really funny.
That's hilarious.
You know, he was one of the greats. I used to play Dangerfields.
In New York?
Yeah, and you,
dark, weird room?
My wife and I would sleep in the storeroom in the back where all the cans of spaghetti sauce and everything was piled up. And that's where we lived for the 2 weeks that I played Rodney. And it's so funny because Rodney was hardly ever there.
Yeah,
and people would come to the front. Is Rodney here tonight? I think Bob is he may be in. Yeah, he may be in late. I think he will be. And then they get the 50
right
cover, you know.
So you're up in Andover, and what gets you into comedy originally? And how did you not end up doing it there? You know all those guys, right?
I did do
You're a little older than them, I think.
I did do it in Boston. But, you know, I quickly learned in Boston.
Where? What was the show? What clubs were there?
Well, I used to work.
Knicks wasn't there, was it?
No. I played the Playboy Club.
Yeah.
I played Lenny's on the Turnpike, which was a funny club. And I played a lot of the strip joints.
Yeah.
Because that's what comics were at, strip joints.
What? Or wait, late 60s are we talking?
I started in 69. I was working the clubs in 70, 71.
Yeah.
And I learned real fast
if you stay in Boston, you wind up with a Boston act. Hey, how about that Mayor White, eh? You know, and then you go somewhere else and nobody knows what the hell. So I realized, as soon as you get kind of popular somewhere, just get out of there.
Yeah.
A lot of the Boston guys made the mistake of just staying there.
Yeah.
And they'd make $1,000 a weekend in Boston. Then they go to Connecticut and make 200 and they go, why should I go to Connecticut? Nobody knows me here. So they just stay. You know, to me, as soon as I started to get a little heat going, I would go to the next place. So I used to drive to the Improv in New York, not every night, but at least 3 or 4 nights a week.
From Andover?
Yeah, from Boston, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You were living in Boston at the time?
Yeah, to go on at the Improv, yeah.
So you'd set out at like, what, 6? And then just...
Yeah, set out at 6, 7, get there about 10, wait around for a couple of hours.
And that was when Bud had it.
That's when Bud had it.
Yeah.
You know, it was a magical place.
The Improv. I performed there at the end when Silver had it and it was sort of on its way out.
You know, it was just...
Missing a letter on the wall.
I had never even met another comedian.
Yeah.
So I thought I was the only guy in the world doing this.
Up in Boston?
Yeah, you just didn't meet... You know, I would hear my mother's friends say, you know, Kathy's boy, Jay's... Some kind of comedian. Oh, that's so sad. I mean, you know, it didn't even seem like a viable...
Yeah.
What is he doing with his
life? Right, yeah.
It was that... You
sure. Just,
and then when you went to New York...
But there were no guys up there then?
No, what used to happen, I had an apartment in Boston. In
what part?
Right on 1754 Commonwealth Avenue.
Was it Cross Street? Was that up by
up near Brookline. Yeah, up near BC.
Okay.
Near Chestnut Hill.
Yeah.
And whenever... comedians from out of town came in to do the Playboy Club, they'd stay at my apartment.
Yeah,
I would just put an open invitation. Hi, I'm Jay Leno, the comedian. Oh, okay. Richard Lewis, Billy Crystal, Freddie Prinze. Freddie Prinze sat up all night once with a gun, just firing into the wall, and blew a hole from the bedroom into the living
room. In your apartment?
Yeah, just blew a hole into it.
That is, I'll
tell you a funny story about living in Boston. You know, Commonwealth Avenue.
Yeah.
You have Commonwealth Avenue, and then you have a little strip of grass, and then you have a little street, like an access street.
Right.
So one day I come out of my apartment, and I see a refrigerator on the access street that someone has thrown away. Yeah. So I go, oh, man. I said, you know something? They should bust the door off of that, because a kid gets in there.
Yeah.
So I go to my apartment, get my hammer, bang, bang, I smash the hinge. I bend the door, but I bend it all the way back. Okay. And I slam it. It won't shut. Great. I did my good deed. I go out to my apartment. I come downstairs about a half hour later. This woman crying, this guy, hey, you live around here? I said, yeah, I live there. You see somebody smashing his refrigerator? What? It's a refrigerator. I said, it's an old refrigerator. Throw it away. It's not old. We're just moving in. It's a brand new goddamn refrigerator. And I look at it and I realize, oh, it is a brand new refrigerator. I went, maybe somebody thought it was, something. What would think that? It's brand new. I said, no, I didn't see anything. Oh, man. Yeah, it was pretty stupid.
That's good. So a lot of time. So the first time you met a lot of the guys was at your house, in your apartment, because they were in town. And you, what were you, house MC, or you just always worked there?
No, I wasn't house MC. There was no, the Playboy Club, you had to do 6 shows a night. You had the Playmate Room and the Playboy Room.
Where was it, downtown?
Downtown, yeah. And each room held about 350, 400.
Yeah.
And while the singer was opening downstairs, you used to be closing upstairs. So I'd always pass these singers with big sweat stains under their arm because they'd have to carry the band's instruments up and down between 3 flights. These girls, you know, mascara running there in tears. It's 100 degrees.
Yeah.
I remember Freddie Prinze when he stayed with me. That's when Nixon, the whole thing with Watergate was going on. And Freddie's doing his act and, you know, putting down, the guy said, it's the president! And then Freddie said, Nixon doesn't fuck. He sucks. Uh-huh. Okay, quiet. This guy takes out the gun, fires 2 shots over Freddie's head.
In the club?
In the club. And the whole band dives down. People are screaming. Everybody's running every direction. They grab the guy. They throw him out. Yeah, it was a pretty crazy time.
Well, how'd you avoid, like, getting drafted or whatever?
I just had a high number.
You did?
If I gotten drafted, I would have gotten drafted. I was number 278.
Yeah. And did you have people in the family that went? Did
my brother was in Vietnam. Yeah, my brother volunteered. My brother went to military school.
Yeah.
So he was a soldier, yeah.
And when he came back, did you get a sense that he was disillusioned with it?
No, my brother did aerial reconnaissance.
Uh-huh.
And his job was to examine photos and look for targets and that kind of stuff. My brother went to military school.
Right.
He went to Yale, then he was a soldier, so those guys got a little treat a little bit better and, you know, not so, so much.
Right, so he didn't have a sense of
My brother liked being a soldier, you know.
Yeah. And what about your folks? They lived a long time, right?
Yeah, my parents lived a long time. You know, I have a really old family. My father was born in, my grandfather was born in 1857, before the Civil War. And my dad was born in 1910.
Yeah.
So my parents were always...
old.
Old, yeah. Just, yeah. I mean, always old.
Your memory, your first memory is that they're old.
I realize when I look at pictures, I realize I was 18, just about when I, the age, by the age I am now.
Yeah.
My dad was, my dad is my age when I was 18. But he seems so old to me.
Back. How old are you?
I'm 68.
Really?
Yeah.
You look good.
Yeah, it's all right. It's all right.
So, okay, so you're kicking around doing the Playboy Club, Richard Lewis and all those guys. That's when you first meet them. You're going down the improv. So that place, at that time, who were you seeing? What was the deal? What was your relationship with Bud?
I was working for a foreign car dealership. I was working for Foreign Motors of Boston. So what would happen?
Selling what?
Then we had Rolls-Royce, Mercedes-Benz, Citroën, a bunch of foreign cars.
Yeah.
And Rolls-Royces and Mercedes would come into the docks in Elizabeth, New Jersey.
Oh, yeah.
So I would either fly down or take the bus down, pick one up and drive it back. So I'd always stop at the improv and do a set.
In the car?
Yeah. And Bud would see this kid pull up in a Rolls and go, whoa, this must be like the richest kid. So he always gave me, it took a couple of days before he realized what was going on.
Yeah.
But one time I went down there to a guy had bought a Rolls-Royce. Okay, yeah. He gave me $35,000 in a paper bag. That's what a Rolls cost back then.
Yeah, wow.
Okay, I had it in a paper bag.
How many you got?
I don't have any Rolls. And I picked up another Rolls and I drove it. Instead of coming back to Boston, I think I'll stop at the improv and do a set.
Yeah.
So I stopped at the improv and do a set. You know, I got the $35,000 in the paper bag. I got it. And I take it with me on stage and I put it on the piano. And I do my set, and it's one of those nights, everything's killing. Ooh, I come out, well, man, I'm driving back, I'm listening to the set, you know, and I hit the toll booth in Jersey, and I go, where's the paper? Fuck, I realize I left it on the piano.
You did.
So I turn around, and it's now 1:30 in the morning, and there's some singer on stage. Greenery, like eight people. I look around, and I see the bag still on the piano.
Oh, my God.
So I go up, and I, excuse me, I forgot my lunch, sorry. But I'd just be getting out of jail now.
Oh my!
If I had lost that money, yeah. I mean, it was pretty crazy.
That feeling when you went back into that room and saw the bag still there. That must have been a good feeling.
It was a very good feeling.
It was like that. Just
but see, to me, there's nothing like being a stand-up. You know?
Sure.
I mean, like when I watch Michelle Wolf.
Yeah.
I love the fact that she loves to perform.
Yeah.
I mean, I can tell she can't wait to tell a joke. To write a joke and tell a joke. I mean, there's such an enthusiasm. Whether you like her or not, I like her. I hear people go one way. But just the fact that she revels in being a comedian.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, she's so anxious to get out there. She's like an athlete. She runs out and she punches those jokes. And some work and some don't, like all of us do. But she really enjoys it. I don't see a lot of angst. I don't see a lot of... She has that look on her face like, why the fuck was I ever writing for anybody else?
Right. Oh, now, yeah.
You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah,
and yeah. I really like it when I see comedians have that joy. Because to me, it's the greatest job in the world. Whenever I meet comics that go, I'm going to do stand-up for a while, then I'm going to get a sitcom. Oh, please, don't flatter yourself.
Yeah.
Okay?
Is that still the model? Where are they going to get a sitcom?
I don't know. But that's what, Jerry Seinfeld is the guy that put that dream in a lot of people's heads.
Sure.
You know?
You get the development deal.
Yeah.
You know,
it's like Paul Reiser was the first comic to marry a waitress from a comedy club. Yeah. Then every other waitress in comedy, well, I got her. And his wife, Paul, is great.
That's what he started?
Yeah, well, she worked at the club. And, you know, now she's a psychologist, very successful. But it's just funny, you know.
So did you move to New York eventually?
I didn't move. I stayed with a friend, Mike Preminger, and some other people.
Yeah.
It was one of those deals, and I just stayed in New York a lot and commuted back and forth.
So it was just the improv, and then there was like the nightclubs downtown?
It was Catch a Rising Star.
But that was already up?
Yeah, that was up and running. There were a few other clubs around. And it was great, you know? You know, when I watch this show, I'm dying up here, whatever it is. I really can't watch it because there's no joy. I go, what's all the angst? I mean, we love performing. I mean, of course, there were petty jealousies and shit like that.
Well, that's all based on the store, right? So, like, the New York thing was different, right? But you were at the store at that time.
No, but I was at the store, too, and we couldn't... We watched each other's sets. We went with each other to the Tonight Show. When you watch my first Tonight Show, you hear Robin, you hear that laugh in the back. You hear us laughing when he did it. I mean, we used to go with each other to Merv Griffin and Mike Douglas.
So what's the journey then for you? So you're in Boston, you're going to New York, you're doing the thing, right? And who's working in New York at that time?
Richard Lewis. I remember I went to New York,
yeah,
and for some reason, I picked up a copy of the Bergen County News, which is a weekly New Jersey paper. Yeah. And it had comedian Rich Lewis, local boy, you know, to appear on Good Day New Jersey or
right.
something.
Yeah.
And I was, that's the guy I saw at the Improv. You know, I saw him, oh my God. And then,
the paper.
And then I saw him that night. And I said, hey, I saw you in the paper. And I said, this is what a town this is. You 5 minutes and you get to be in the newspaper.
Yeah.
You know, it just seemed like a huge deal. But I would commute back and forth. And one day I was sitting in Boston and...
But who were the guys? Is you and Richard Lewis and what, Bob Altman was there? Like, who was hanging around?
Yeah, Lewis, Elaine Boozler.
Before they came out here. Like, before it was right before. Came.
Yeah. Because everything was in New York. Don't forget, Johnny was in New York. The Tonight Show was in New York.
In this 1970?
Yeah, Merv Griffin was in New York.
Mike
Douglas was in Philadelphia. You know, variety shows were out here. But there weren't talk shows. When Johnny moved, that's when the whole thing changed.
What year was that?
That was 71, I think it was. He came out here.
Oh, no kidding.
And I remember sitting in my apartment in Boston, and I had friends of mine that were like graduating college and become realtors or whatever it is, or lawyers, and they were buying cars and having nice stuff, and I was still kind of living hand to mouth. And I said to myself, you know, if I don't go to L.A. right now, I'm going to want to buy stuff. I'm going to want to have a nicer place.
Yeah.
I'm going to live here in Boston. And I knocked on the door next door, and I told my neighbor, who's a friend of me, take anything you want out of my apartment. I'm leaving. I'm going to L.A. right now. And I just left.
Yeah.
And I slept on the back stairs of the Comedy Store the first week.
That's what you did when you got out there? How'd you know to go there?
I just, you know, as I got off the plane, I had $50. And I said to the cab driver, take me to the Sunset Strip.
Yeah.
He says, how much you got? I said, got $50? Okay, so he drops me off at Sunset and Western. That's what $50 got you from LAX.
Right.
So I got out and go, this doesn't look like, you know.
Not fun.
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking, okay, what's the address of the Comedy Store?
The Ralph's?
The Comedy Store is like 7,000 Sunset. I'm at 300 Sunset. Yeah. Oh, man. So I had like a 9-mile walk and just trying to hitchhike. And you didn't really hitchhike in L.A. You know?
Yeah.
So
not even in 1971
you
or whatever.
Try,
what was it, 71, 72?
Yeah, 70, 71.
Yeah.
So I got to the Comedy Store and I met Mitzi and everybody. And, you know, it was like.
So, but you swept there on the back?
On the back step.
So Sammy was still there? No?
No, Sammy wasn't there. I was still in college. So I would be out here during the summer. I graduated.
Where'd you go?
I went to Emerson. I graduated college in 73, but I would come out here every vacation. I would come out here. It was 73 when I actually moved, but I was out here a lot. I would stay with George Miller was a friend. He was a good guy.
And Emerson at that time, because a lot of guys came out of Emerson, you know, I think they actually teach stand-up comedy there. Now
they do, but then they didn't.
What was it? Just a regular college, or was it still?
It was a regular college. I was dyslexic.
Really?
So I.
Are you still dyslexic?
Yeah, somewhat.
How does that manifest itself?
It's okay. So I just try to memorize stuff.
Ah.
So I remember looking through the course things at Emerson. So speech therapy. Each student is required to give a 20-minute talk at the end of the semester. Well, I can talk for 20 minutes. Shit, that's easy enough. I don't have any interest in speech therapy.
Right.
But you know, I see other people go, oh my God, I can't talk for 20 minutes. I can't do it. It's horrible talk for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
I thought, well, that's easy enough. And so I managed to get through, and I gave my parents the degree when I graduated. And that's when I permanently moved here.
But is that what sort of inspired you to do stand-up? Was talking to, you know, in college?
It helped any place you got a chance.
But like, what sparked it for you? Like initially, what made you decide? Like, oh, this is what I'm going to do.
I decided because in Boston there were literally, if not hundreds of colleges,
certainly
close to 100, and most students had no money.
Yeah.
And they were willing to be entertained by people with no talent, you know. Yeah. It was the kind of thing, you know, they put a candle in the cafe and they become the two-toed cafe.
Yeah.
And it was mostly guys with flashlights under their chins going, stop your war machine, man. Then lights would go out and it'd be silent and it would be ooh. Yeah. You know, so the idea of doing comedy really didn't, nobody really was doing much comedy. It was pretty serious stuff. So I used to MC and try to throw some jokes in and, you know, and you go to the next college. Well, I MC'd down at Chandler last week. Oh, okay, we can come see MC our show. You didn't really make any money. Maybe you got 10 bucks or something like that.
And that's how you started?
Yeah, I used to go to bars in Boston, and I'd put $50 on the bar, and I would say to the bartender, let me go up and tell some jokes. If I'm funny, give me my 50 back. If I'm not funny and nobody and people leave, you keep the 50. And they went, oh, okay. So a couple of times I lost the 50, but for the most times, yeah. It was okay.
Yeah.
Or they'd say, here, keep your money, kid. But we don't really do comedy. Don't come back. But, you know, just anywhere to get experience.
Oh, and there was, so there was really no clubs in that you...
There weren't any clubs. There were just strip clubs. Yeah. I used to work with a stripper named Lily Pagan. I work with a stripper named...
In the combat zone?
I Need a Man.
Yeah.
And these, you know, it was really interesting because these are women... I was 19 to 20. They were probably in their 40s.
Yeah.
Big, strong women.
Yeah.
And, you know, in those days, you're either a secretary or you worked at the shoe factory.
Yeah.
Or you were an educated woman. You know, there weren't a lot of jobbers. And these women weren't hookers or prostitutes. They were just, I remember they all had short hair. They'd wear wigs. And we'd go do a gig out at like Fort Devens. And they would put they would take out power tools and put together this giant champagne glass that one of them would take a bath in. You know, and I would stand there and tell jokes while they did that. Uh-huh. So one day I'm telling jokes, and this guy said, "Hey, you suck! Hey, kid, you're an asshole!" Yeah, and maybe she just gets out of the tub nude, totally covered with, goes over, punches the guy in the face, breaks his nose. The guy's nose literally splits open. He's bleeding all over the place. He's screaming. His friends are going, "Oh!" just hilarious. Just really funny. I mean, it was great times.
Great bloody times.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so you're coming back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
You meet Mitzi. What's the first time you meet Mitzi like? Because, you know, look, I was a doorman there in the 80s when, you know, when Sam was big. Like, I was there for a couple years. That's sort
of what... Sam's the reason I left.
Yeah.
You know, Sam would come in with the guns and the coke. And, you know, he was unusual. He was really good.
Yeah.
He had that primal scream.
Yeah.
Which brought, it's like when you see a guy do blues better than anybody else. You can't explain why it's better.
Yeah.
It's just an intensity. But then he would come in with his posse after a couple of years, and there'd be guns and coke. And I just said, you know, I'm a comedian. When this place gets busted, I don't want to be downtown and explain that I don't do coke. So I just stopped going.
You just stayed away?
Yeah.
But you were, but when you first met her in the 71 or 72,
mm-hmm.
I mean, what was that scene like? Because, I mean, the strip must have been out of control. I mean, you sound to me like you're kind of a conservative guy, but it was a wild time.
I am a conservative guy. You know, she was like your comedy mom. I mean, that's the funny thing about it, you know, when that strike happened, she was like a mom who couldn't let go. We loved Mitzi. I thought she was great. She gave us all a chance. Very nurturing with everybody. Then it got to the point, well, here's what you should be doing in your act.
Uh-huh.
Well, I don't want to do that. No, you need to do that if you want to work here. You know, it got to that point with, I remember Jack Grayman, she wanted him to change his name to Jackie Bananas and wear a yellow jacket.
And
you know, just making suggestions, which she was like a mom whose kids are growing up now and, you know, you can't, they're 18 now, Mom. You can't tell them what to do.
What'd she
know?
Tell you to do?
It's not that she told me to do anything.
She told me to wear a scarf.
Did she tell you that?
Yeah.
Well, see, I was also friends with Bud, and she didn't like that. So there was a bit of a distance. I was one of the few people that could play both clubs.
That didn't work out for Jimmy Walker.
No, that didn't work out for a lot of people. And she just got possessive. And I don't think she was... I was always very grateful to her.
Yeah,
I mean, I was sorry, just for having a place where we could go. You know, just to meet other people that were comedians was like man, I have something I can talk about. I don't have to explain to people and watch people roll their eyes when I say I want to be a comic. And yeah, okay.
Like, I mean, I can't, like, I'm trying, I always try to put the history together, and I've read the book, and I've had a couple of the old guys in here. But like at that time, I mean, you come out there, you don't have agents, you don't have a manager, you're
still
at the Comedy Store, right? And is Letterman there at that time?
Letterman had showed up, And Letterman was probably the best wordsmith, is the word, that I'd ever seen.
Yeah.
I think he admired my ability to be on stage and not give a shit and just sort of work.
Yeah.
And I admired his ability to weave. I remember the first joke that really caught me. He said, we here at, you know, he talked about working at a local news station at WKR, are diametrically opposed to the use of orphans as yardage markers on public golf courses. And he had a whole thing about that. And I thought, I just liked the lyrical sense of how he put that together.
So
I went up to him and I introduced myself. And I said, man, I really like the way you weave this, you tell a story into the picture. He goes, wow. How can you get up there and just not be nervous? I said, no, that's a, so that always used to be my thing. When I would do Dave, I would go next door and buy like a huge meatball sandwich, you know?
Yeah.
And when I would see Dave coming down the hall to makeup, I'd go, Dave, take it. How could you eat that before you go on? Jesus Christ, what's the matter with you? Oh, Dave, it's delicious. So, and then I got to the point where I would bring the sandwiches out on the show, you know? And he was just so, he didn't like doing stand-up. I mean, great comedian, a good broadcaster, and I'm not disparaging. He just didn't like the road.
Right.
To me, I love the road. Dave hated it. I think he went out with Tony Orlando a couple of times. He just hated it more than anything. And it was just funny. But I always had a great admiration. I think he took from me maybe a little bit of the performing part, and I took from him, that's the way you write a joke.
Right,
that's
better way to say it.
And then it's not, you know, you're not stealing from one another. It's not that. You just, okay, that's, you're seeing the right way it should be done.
And who else impressed you at that time? Did you get to see Richard Pryor all the time at the store?
Yes, I love Richard Pryor. I would ask Mitzi to put me on after Richard every single night.
For the workout?
Well, you know, we comics are inherently lazy. You just go where the audience is.
So you said, don't go.
So
that kind of thing?
I thought I had an hour's worth of material. Uh-huh. After following Richie, I realized I had about 18 minutes.
Yeah.
And now, not sarcastically, actually 18. Because, you know, when the audience is on a roll, they laugh at anything.
Yeah.
You know, I can remember once Robin Williams came up to me, the height of Mork and Mindy. And he said, I got some new stuff. Watch my set. Tell me if it's any good. And he's on, and he's saying, Happy Lord, no! You know, Robin.
Yeah.
He's yelling the jokes out, and the people are screaming. And he said, is the new stuff any good? And I said, no, it sucks. He goes, I thought it sucks, but I can't tell. They just laugh at everything that I do.
Right.
So, I mean, and that's not a shot at Robin.
Right.
It's just the fact that you can't tell how you're doing because the crowd is so crazy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
To me, my guy was always Robert Klein.
Because
I wasn't Jewish, I wasn't poor, we weren't rich, but I wasn't poor. So I didn't have any of the hooks. I wasn't a minority.
You saw him in New York? Where'd you
meet? Yeah. And Klein was a guy that was 10 years older than me.
Yeah.
And was essentially a middle class kid and talked about stupid shows on television, you know, or trying to get into college, whatever it might be, you know. I really identified with him, and Carlin also. Carlin, another white guy, you know, not a minority, just a funny guy.
Yeah.
Didn't have a hook, just had good jokes.
Yeah. And he wrote the hell out of him.
Yeah. Great comic.
Yeah.
I mean, just
it's so interesting because, like, Klein's a little more free, well, not free form, but bigger bits than I think you do, right? Like, he did long executed things.
Yeah. I always enjoy Robert. He liked being an actor.
Yeah.
I would see him on Law and Order or something playing an attorney, and I would say to myself, you go on The Tonight Show and own network television for 8 minutes where you're the only thing on. Why?
Yeah.
Why somehow a part in a TV show? Why? That's better?
But everyone seemed to try it. You tried it, right? I mean, didn't you?
Oh, I tried it. I hated that.
Well, but I mean, it's like, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but I think, well, Robert, that was always his problem, right? Yale trained actor, like, and, you know, he wanted to do Broadway. He was in that hit, They're Playing Our Song.
Right.
And like, and like, I, from my read on it, is that when Robert had the opportunity to become the biggest comic in the country, something went wrong. I mean, it became Cheech and Chong or somebody
else. Right.
The timing was off.
Yeah, yeah. But he was good. He had a summer show called Comedy Tonight, I think it was.
Yeah, I kind of remember that.
Because I worked at the car dealership, and he came in to buy a car.
Yeah?
And
a Rolls?
No, Mercedes. I believe I installed the radio in it. Yeah. Yeah.
But you've got no Rolls in your collection.
No, I don't. I'm not a Rolls Royce guy.
You got some Mercedes?
Yeah, I got some older Mercedes.
Yeah. It just seems like when we're comics, like you, if you're out here, you're going to take the TV shots. Because I remember seeing you show up in weird old movies.
Yeah, you know, yeah, I think did a couple of movies.
I think you're in one smoking a pipe. I think you smoked a pipe.
That was Silver Bears with Michael. You know, I was standing on Sunset Boulevard, and a car pulls up.
Yeah.
He goes, What's your name? My name is Jay Leno. My name is Ivan Passa. I am a director. I am doing film with Michael Caine. Do you have a look I like? Are you an actor? I said, yes. Do you want to go to Switzerland and Morocco to do a movie? I said, sure. Give me your name. Okay. So I gave him my name. This isn't going to happen. Then I get the call. Here's your plane ticket. All right. I'm on the way to Switzerland and Morocco. And I did this movie. And my parents were like stunned. I fly to Hollywood.
Yeah.
And then I call my parents from Morocco. What are you doing in Morocco? I'm doing a movie. What? What are you talking about? A guy stopped me on the street corner, asked me if I wanted to be in a movie. And that's where I am, Mom. I went to Morocco, England, and Milan, Italy.
Yeah.
We were over there for like 8 weeks doing this film. It was pretty stupid.
Yeah, but you just it was right at the beginning?
Yeah, right at the beginning. Yeah, it was hilarious.
So when you do these things, but like when you did the TV shots and stuff, it's just like you... Because what, did you know you weren't an actor, or did you just not like the gig, or you just was like,
what? I don't know. I was just grabbing at straw. I don't know.
Yeah, but you, at that time early on, were you opening for musical acts? Were you on the road?
Yeah, I was on the road a lot. I opened for everybody from... I remember I was opening for Perry Como.
Yeah.
And he was a great guy.
Yeah.
Perry Como said to me, hey, who's that girl? What's that girl? What's her name? That's Mavis.
Yeah. Says,
what are you going to do with that girl? Going to marry her? I said, when I get some money, I'll marry her. So he took out $2,000. He said, here, here's $2,000. Go marry her. And I did. And we're still married 38 years later.
That's Perry Como did that?
Yeah. He's a great guy. I mean, he just said, here, here's $2,000. Go marry her.
Quit making excuses.
Yeah. And I said, no, I had to marry her. Okay. No, he was a great guy.
Did you find that, like, when you worked the road with were there guys that you worked the road with that were of another generation that you know, you were able to...
Oh, another generation. I remember at the Improv once. This is why, you know, I don't bitch about political correctness.
Yeah.
Because to me, times change. Change with the times or die.
Right.
You know, the reason the Japanese beat Detroit is... Detroit, well, we can't meet these new rules. We can't meet these regular... There's no way we can meet these emissions. Yeah. They can't be done. And the Japanese said... Tell us what the rules are. We'll follow them. Fine. Yeah. And they came out with engines that were extremely efficient, extremely, less smog and fuel efficient. And so when I see comics that bitch and moan, but change your act, okay? I mean, when I started, some sort of gay joke was a staple of everybody's act.
Sure.
Nobody does them anymore.
Right.
Why? Because times change.
Right, exactly.
You don't do that anymore.
You don't have to say that word anymore. They don't want to be called that anymore. Don't call them that.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. But the idea that you keep fighting this, you need to change with the times. You
right.
know? I mean, I see a lot of gay comedians and lesbian comedians doing comedy from their point of view, and it's just as funny. It's just a different point of view.
Right.
So, and speaking of that, at the Improv, there was this old comedian, I can't remember his name. He would come in, and he's obviously been working since, like, World War II.
Yeah.
This was in 69, 70. And he would get up there, and he'd go, hey, fellas, you know when you go in a bar and guys in uniform, you know how they got all the girls? You know what I'm talking about? Boo! Fuck the war! Nixon's, you know, people just screaming.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the height of it. And he goes, yeah. I don't get it. He says, I say, look, you know, this is a lot of anti-war protest guys. Who, you know, now women like guys that don't go in. You
right.
know, the dodge. The
yeah.
I said, you got to update your act. You can't. He goes, oh, yeah. Comes, he goes, watch my act tonight. He goes, hey, fellas, you know how you got to buy out of the Green Berets? You know how they get all the girls? I go, no, you can't go to Green Beret. It's the same thing as what you just did. You can't update the act that way.
Yeah,
so that's what I mean. You just have to change with the times.
I remember seeing you. I can't remember. Like I remember two very distinct jokes because I thought they were hilarious. I thought you were great. I must have been in junior high or something. I don't know if you were on Mike Douglas or Merv Griffin, but you're sitting in the big chair, And they cut away to commercial. And it was just an aside. You go, does the chair fold into the wall now? Are we going to, like, on a game show? And I thought it was the funniest thing in the world.
Oh, well, thanks. But see, you were never a fan, though.
What of you?
Right, you were never.
No, that's not true.
No, it's not.
No, no. I remember seeing you at the Improv. Oh, okay. Like in like the I'd see you when I was in college. I'd come out here for the summer, and I'd see you. There was the one joke that like these are ones I remember just from for whatever reason. You said I saw a commercial. It was brought to us by the. The Spring Peach Advisory Board.
Oh no.
Okay. The what peach? What is it?
No, it was the.
I can't.
The Kling Peach Kling, Advisory Board.
Right,
Eat delicious Kling peaches. A message from the Kling Peach Advisory Board. And what kind of cushy ass job is that?
Yeah, yeah, that's it.
Bob, this man on line 9 wants to have Kling peaches with cornflakes. Yeah, that's fine. I got no problem with that.
No problem with
Look,
that.
Hold my problem. Hold my calls, Grace. That's what the joke was.
Yeah.
But you know what's so funny is when you take over the Tonight Show.
Yeah.
You've got to do a 12-minute monologue every single night.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't be hip every single. You just can't.
No, of course.
It can't be. So I would just get labeled with this, you know, and just get beat up all the time. That's why when you came to see me, when I invited you to the show,
yeah.
I went into the dressing room.
I know.
You know, and I said,
I thought you didn't like me. I thought you, that's what you said.
I thought you didn't like me because, you know, when you're... Who do you tackle? The guy with the ball, the quarterback. And to me, the Tonight Show was the ball. And suddenly, I was getting attacked from all sides for basically doing the same thing I always did. I mean, my job was to keep the Tonight Show number one and still try to keep a younger audience as well as an older audience.
Well, I remember what happened was, like, you know, even before, like, you know, the shift, like, you took some shit, like, when I was starting out and I was an angry comic, I think we weren't of the same ilk, really.
Right, right.
You're more now, more relaxed, I'm funnier, whatever. But
are funnier. I enjoyed your special. I watched the last one.
Oh, thank you. But like, I remember when, you know, Hicks took you on, and that was like the first punch.
You know what happened with Hicks?
He said, you know, what's the Doritos saying, Satan and everything else?
Well, what it was, Hicks was 14 years old.
Yeah.
I was down and working in Austin, I think it was.
Yeah.
They said, we have a comedy class here.
Yeah.
Some young people want to do comedy. And my rule is the person who thinks you suck and walks out of the room is always going to be the funniest one there.
Yeah.
Because it's just an arrogance, you know. Okay.
Right, right.
So Hicks kind of goes, this sucks. And he walks out of the room.
Yeah.
Okay. So I called him aside. And then we became friends.
This is when he's 14.
14, 15.
50, when he, right, first right, started. Okay. Yeah.
And we sort of interacted. Yeah. And I talked with his parents and whatnot. And then... He wanted to come on The Tonight Show, and he had this Jesus routine. And I said, Bill, I'd love to put you on, but they won't let you do that.
So this is right at the beginning, 92?
Yeah, I guess that's what it
is. Yeah.
I said, Bill, they won't let you put that on.
Yeah.
And he, you know, I said, I called Letterman. Letterman will do it, you know.
Yeah.
I said, well, I can't, I don't own my show. Dave owns his show, okay?
Yeah.
I can't tell you they're not going to cut it up. So he just started, Jay Leno, fuck you, Doritos. And all right, fine. And you know, and then he went on Dave, and of course the NBC censors.
Oh, that was that time.
They cut it all up.
Yeah.
So then he got mad at that. And then it was just sort of,
Then he was out on his outlaw journey.
Yeah, brilliant kid.
Great, great.
Really funny kid.
Yeah.
I haven't talked to his parents in a while, his mom in a while. But yeah, I mean, that was really a sad thing, but I just like the anger and the angst. And
yeah, no, he's great and a great joke writer. Yeah,
yeah,
well, that,
yeah.
But so that you, some of the seed to that was a reaction. It was not necessarily personal, but he was up against it. What he wanted to do was radical, and the mainstream, you know, didn't have a place for him.
I think that's fair to say.
You know, but like just a real genius guy. But I think like in you addressing me, addressing you, thinking I didn't like you. I think at the time, well, you know, I grew up with Letterman, so then there was that wave of that,
right.
And then that book and that movie, and then you know you're put in a position to be like, what was going on?
Well, I was the establishment guy, and Dave was the hip guy.
Right.
And that's probably fair to say.
Yeah.
And we were on at exactly the right times. I was more for mainstream people.
But do you have any regrets about how it went down with The Tonight Show in terms of your relationship with him? Like in terms of getting The Tonight Show over him?
Well, here's the thing. I was guest hosting for 5 years.
Yeah.
I was the only guest host
yeah.
for 5 years.
Why is that?
Well, Dave had done it.
Yeah.
A bunch of times.
Right.
And of course, as excellent as Dave is.
Yeah.
Dave doesn't like network suits.
Yeah.
And one of the network guys just asked one of the talent coordinators, my two college-age kids are in town. They want tickets for the show. And Letterman heard said, no, they're not coming in. And it's our show. No, I don't want. And I remember when they gave me the show, one of the guys said, I wasn't going to go through 20 years of that. You know, I mean, to me, I think he probably would have gotten it.
Yeah.
I don't know. But don't forget, it's sort of, it's a double-edged sword because they had a hit show, a huge hit show.
Yeah.
You had Johnny, who was seen as the old school on his way out. David was the bright, shining light at 12:30.
Yeah.
Well, why not bring a new guy in to take over from Johnny and then keep the bright light shining at 12:30?
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think Dave was somewhat a victim of his own success because the show was so big and perfect in that time spot.
Yeah.
And they weren't sure if that would work at 11:30. They had a guy guest hosting who was getting really good ratings and doing well.
Mm-hmm.
All right, why don't we just do this? And that's what they did. I mean, you know, people would get mad at me, and what was I supposed to do? Was I supposed to turn it down? Was I supposed to go, no?
Right.
I mean, it wasn't, you know, there's this sort of thing that somehow I snuck in at the last minute and stole the ball here. I was guest hosting for 5 years. The only guest host on the show.
Yeah.
I was doing weeks, 2 weeks at a time, 3 weeks at a time when Johnny was out. And then it got turned over to me. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right, fine.
And did you reconcile with Dave?
I think so. I think Dave, you know something, we've always had a mutual admiration for each other.
Uh-huh.
I think he was angry.
Yeah.
Rightfully so.
Yeah.
The decision was not mine. The decision was NBC's. You know, like, for example, I'm someone who would go and visit every single NBC affiliate. They wanted me to do that.
Yeah.
I don't think Dave would do that. It's just not his nature. It's neither right nor wrong.
Yeah.
But somehow, you cheated. You went and visited all these. No, I didn't. That's part of the job. The Tonight Show was the traditional
show. You didn't mind being a company guy. You like going out. You can schmooze. You do the stand-up.
You know something? If you're taking the company money, you're a company guy, whether you pretend to or not. You know, if you don't want to be a company guy, don't take the company money.
Right.
Okay? If you're going to be a company guy, take the company guy.
Right. Well, I think that, like, also in reaction to you thinking I didn't like you, I think that, like, I know you've dealt with it because I've heard stories, you know, like, you hear other comics saying bad shit about you and you call them up and you go, like,
I heard what's it about? I don't mind it if they know me and, okay, did I fuck you over? Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
But, well, wait, that never happened. You know, right. I read all these stories that... just crazy stuff. Just crazy stuff.
I just always liked that you would call. Like, I remember the first time you called me, I'm like, it's like, oh, Jay Leno, hey. And then there's a part like, why did I get my number? What are you doing?
Yeah. Well, I mean, why not go to, you know, to me, if there's something going around, you go to the source.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't a great one for social media. I wasn't going to talk. I don't like to talk shit about other comics.
Yeah.
I don't. And I don't really slam any other comics. You know, it's such a small fraternity, and there are very few people that really understand what it is we do.
Yeah.
It's like Kimmel and I had a bit of a thing going. You know, Kimmel came from the Letterman camp and the Howard Stern camp, and, you know...
Oh, yeah, he did that thing where he sandbagged it.
Yeah, he didn't like... Yeah, it's a, all right.
Yeah.
But what people don't realize is I let that go on the air.
Sure.
I could have edited it and just...
Right. It wasn't live. Was it?
No, it wasn't live.
Yeah, right.
You know, so we didn't. I said, look, if that's what he wants, that's fine.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And, you know, when his son had his incident, I called him up and we had a nice talk. And I said, look, I think he's really funny.
It's good.
And the funny thing is, he's more like me probably than any other host. He's Italian.
Yeah.
He's got kind of a blue-collar background, which I like.
Yeah.
He's a funny guy.
Yeah.
So we reconciled. And I think we're, I don't know if we're friends, but... You know, I just called him up and said, look, I'm not going to say anything bad about you. I think you're really funny. I think you did a great job. He does an incredible job on the Oscars. I mean...
Oh, yeah, it's great. It's great.
You know, I turned that job down because I didn't think I could be any good at it. And I watch him. He just does an amazing job. It's really funny. It's really topical.
Yeah, it's
He's good. Got a great interaction.
Well, let me ask you a question. Because, like, I'm just trying to track this thing. So, we got the Hicks thing, and then you took the job, and then there was the tension with Letterman. There was the Letterman camp, and then, you know, and then, you know, there only seemed to be a Letterman camp, and somehow you were the, you know, you were the guy that did something bad.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But the truth of the matter is that, you know, like, your assumption by me was wrong, because I always loved you as a comic, and you were one of the great comics, and you're still a great comic, but we all knew you as a comic, out right. there doing it, always turning over new material, and you're a great club act, and, you know, we knew you were a lifer and a veteran and the real deal. So, like, I got the feeling with you that somehow after the Tonight Show that there was this thing always hanging over you that, like, how did so many comics decide you were an asshole?
Did
it bother you, though? I mean,
of
like...
Yes, everything bothered. Look, you're a comic. What do you like to be liked.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I invited you on the show. I don't think this guy likes me. Let me bring him on and see what it's all about.
but that was just because, like, Conan, like, was, you know, he put me on his show four times a year.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I was there at the beginning.
That's okay.
And but I wasn't out saying, you know.
See, that was another odd situation. Because when I got to Tonight Show, okay, Conan, come on. And Conan was going week by week in terms of, is he going to stay on, or are they going to cancel it?
What do you mean, after? When was this?
The first time he was on the late night show following me.
Oh.
And they were renewing him like 6 weeks at a time.
Oh, early on, the 90s. Yeah. Oh, yeah, 90s.
And Ohmyer came to me and said, what do you think? I said, I think he's funny. I said, you can't put people on in 3 weeks, 4 weeks. I mean, you know, just renew him.
Yeah.
And I said, listen, why don't we do this? I will promote him every night after my show. I'll say who his guests are and stay tuned for Conan. I will do that every single night.
You're telling this to Don Ohmyer, who's the head of the network at the time.
And Don said, okay, would you do that? I said, yeah, I like him. Okay.
Yeah.
And I did. And it worked fine. And then one day I get, you know, a network guy comes to me and goes, you didn't hear from me, but Conan wants you out. And I said,
what? When was this? In the 90s?
This was, in the 2000s.
Uh-huh.
Because he was getting hot and we were doing well and he was doing well.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And then I don't have an agent or a manager.
Right.
I learned my lesson with that one. So this was
You just got a lawyer? You got nobody?
I don't really have a lawyer, but...
Yeah. If you need one, you can find one.
I kind of do. Yeah, I can do it. Yeah. So I just get this call. What's this all about? Okay. Next thing I know, they want to give the Tonight Show to Conan. That's what they want to do? Okay, I said, I still got four more years. So they want you to announce it, or they're going to announce it. Fine. So I said, oh, I'm stepping down. They want to give it to him. Okay, fine.
In 4 years.
Yeah. Okay, but we're still number one.
Yeah.
Then I think Craig Ferguson came along. And suddenly...
On CBS.
Whoa, he was pulling from Conan, and I don't know if he was beating Conan, but certainly a run for the money.
Not a huge market at that hour anyways.
Right, and the networks were like, oh, wait a minute, the bloom is off the rose here a bit, and what's going to happen?
Uh-huh.
Okay, so then that comes along, and okay, they want me to go, fine. So I get an offer from ABC, I call Kimmel, they want to move me at 11:30, you to 12:30, would you do that? He said, yeah, I think I'd do that. Okay, fine. Well, everybody happy? Fine. And then NBC goes, I tell you, why don't you go out at 10 o'clock? And I said, all right, fine. And somehow, Jay Leno, it's not fair to come. You know, hey, it's welcome to show business, okay?
Uh-huh.
Okay, so.
But did you think it would be a good place for you? Or you just wanted to work?
I wanted to work. And second of all, they said to me, look, whether this works out or not, we'll pay your staff, your entire staff, for 2 years. And everybody in my show had never done it before, with the exception of three or four people. All the writers, we had the same writers for 23 years. Everybody, I said, you guys want to get paid for another 2 years? Wanted to, all right, fine.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
You know, all right, fine. So we did that. We had a really loyal staff. You know, when the ratings started to drop on a lot of late night shows, they wanted to do cutbacks, and I was making such stupid money anyway.
Yeah.
It was $30 million a year. So I said, let's cut it in half to 15, and we'll spread the second half out among everybody. Okay, fine. Okay, so now they love you and all that kind of stuff. Great. So everybody's happy, and we're doing fine. So I said, you guys want to do a show at 10 o'clock? And the network was really up for this because they had tried it in the 60s with Jack Parr and then thought maybe it could have worked.
But they were panicking.
They were panicking because
about the Tonight
nobody
show.
Was watching the 10 o'clock shows.
But wasn't there a panic around the number drop from...
There was. Yeah. There was. The numbers were dropping before I came on.
Yeah.
Okay. And then they put us on at 10, which was seen as basically the same thing. And I guess the numbers dropped even more. But I believe he was getting notes from the network and not paying attention to them. They thought the sketches were too long or whatever it might be. I don't want to talk about his thing.
Sure.
That's, he can talk about
right.
that. Okay. I mean, there was talk about me doing a half-hour show and then Conan coming on at midnight.
Right, right. So you starting at the time the Tonight Show started.
Right, and then...
putting him on, and he said, then it's not the Tonight Show. That was the deal that broke there.
That's when Conan quit.
Right.
So then it was like, oh, he quit. You want to come back? I said, sure. So we came back, and we were number one until we left.
Okay, as somebody looking back at this, mm-hmm. two questions. Do you have any regrets about the way it all was handled?
No, I don't, because it wasn't my decision other than to say yes or no.
Mm-hmm.
There was no scheme. I read one blog where it said, well, you know, they had to take Leno back or pay him $150 million. I go, okay, well, either I'm a genius or I'm an idiot. You can't be both. Why would they have to pay him? Why would you have to fire a guy and then pay him $150 million? It doesn't make any, it, I mean, it, it, does, it just didn't make any sense.
Do you think Conan should have stayed on at midnight?
To me, when you're on, you're winning.
I know, because I think that's what Seinfeld said, too.
Yeah, to me, as long as you're on, you're winning. I always had a play and pay contract.
Uh-huh.
You know, I always meet comics that go, you know, they're not using me, and they're paying me $10,000 a week.
Yeah.
I go, yeah, but when that ends, your career is over. Because nobody likes to spend money on something that's not making money.
Yeah.
So to me, it was, oh, if you're going to use me, you got to have me on the air.
Yeah.
I believe that was another reason why I was on at 10 o'clock. That was part of it also.
Yeah.
Okay. So to me, that was it. Yes, I think Conan should have done it. And then I would have retired 4 or 5 years later anyway.
Yeah.
And if the show's, look, you're either popular or not. I mean, you rise and fall on your own.
Yeah.
You know, I always tell comedians, they hired me to be on this shitty sitcom. Yeah, they're hiring you because it's a shitty sitcom.
Yeah.
So they're thinking you can make it funny. That's why you're on, okay?
Yeah.
Hopefully it won't be a shitty sitcom because you're on it.
Yeah.
That's the way it works.
Right.
We had bad lead-ins when I was doing The Tonight Show in the 90s. Just awful. You know, all these 10 o'clock bad dramas that weren't going anywhere. The only one, ER, was the only hit.
Yeah.
But everybody did. You rise and fall on your own numbers.
Whatever, yeah, yeah. yeah. So let's go back in time just a bit for a minute.
Sure.
I saw Tom Dreesen the other night, and he performed at the Comedy Store for the first time in like 40 years.
Right. Oh, yeah. I love Tom.
He went on the main room. Argus brought him up.
Yeah.
Now, do you, like, in Mitzi Pass, did you go to the memorial or anything?
I didn't go to the memorial because I got a stupid phone call.
Hey, Jalilo, you better go to Mitzi's funeral, man. You're going to be your asshole. You better cancel any gigs you have.
And I go, you know, I don't want to go through all this again.
Who was it?
I don't know. I didn't know who it was.
Is that really?
Yeah, and I just went, really? It's 30 years later. This bullshit's still going on. So I figured I'm not going to go and cause it.
You better go. You're not going to get spots.
Right. I went. I remember I did Tim Conway and a bunch of radio shows.
Uh-huh.
Just talking about how much we love Mitzi and how much he liked comedy and... you know, really helped us all out.
But do you have an emotional connection to that time and to the other comics?
Incredible emotional connection.
The guys, is there any guys left from that time that you're still in touch with? I mean,
all of the guys, Dreesen, everybody.
Yeah.
You know, I knew Steve Lebetkin.
Yeah, I know, right, the guy who jumped.
Steve Lebetkin, he had one bit called Cat News.
Yeah.
It was something about a newsman reading news for cats.
Yeah.
It was pretty funny.
Yeah.
And he auditioned with that.
Yeah.
At the Improv, and I thought, it's very funny, Bet, how you doing, blah, blah. Then he got some money from his father or somebody, he got some
investors. For the movie.
And he did a movie called Cat News.
Yeah.
And that was the only bit he really had.
Uh-huh.
And then, I don't know whether he was getting high or what, he just didn't come up with more stuff.
Yeah.
And then he went, and I think Mitzi said, nah,
it was the strike too, right? He
the strike was going on,
and he
jumped off the roof of the Hyatt House next door,
right? Yeah,
killed himself,
right? But some of it was because he was panicking. Obviously, he had some mental problems, but he was panicking that he wasn't getting spots.
Right,
I talked to Tom about it, and he said, yeah, that like he was one of the strikers, and I guess he mentally had everything invested in this thing.
Right.
Rumor, you can validate a rumor to me or not, and it's all right if it's not true, but I heard that somebody the next day after he jumped called the Comedy Store to put him for spots as Lebetkin.
No, I don't know. I didn't hear
that. You didn't do that?
I wouldn't do that. Steve was a friend of mine. you know.
Yeah, of course. I don't mean to be.
No. But it was just.
It's a comic thing, you know.
Yeah, no, and that's what I mean. It's a comic. Yeah, you have to go.
Somebody's going to do something.
You have to go for the joke.
Yeah. But you do. You have warm feelings about that time, and
I love that time. You know what it was? Because you there was a sense of belonging to something. I mean, when you're a young comic, you have no idea where your life is going. You don't want to sell insurance. You don't want to work in a factory.
Yeah.
You just don't want to be a regular person.
Yeah.
You just want to do something or die trying, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And to meet other people who think like that. I mean, I went a whole year without ever meeting anyone else that wanted to be in show business in Boston. That people look at you like, oh, you're a comedian, huh? Oh, man, that's kind of weird.
Yeah.
You know, girls with a comedian, sure. Like, where do you work?
Right.
Well, you know, you get up and you just tell jokes, you talk. It just seems, then you come here or New York and you meet guys that want to be lighting directors or choreographers or gay guys that want to be dancers. Well,
yeah.
In Boston, you don't, no gay guy would say you want to be a dancer. You get beat up back in the, you know, I mean, it was like an amazing time to meet other people.
Right.
You know, I think it's like, maybe if you're a gay person and suddenly you meet other gay people and you realize
this is where show business
is. Here are people I have something in common with.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, of course. And this is where you know, you kind of do that work.
I mean, it was a very exciting time. I got picked up twice for vagrancy on Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah.
And the cops would see me. In fact, when I got my star, we put the star where I got picked up twice.
Yeah.
The cops would see you about 8 o'clock at night and go, where you living? I don't have. Get in the back. And they put you back in the police car. And you'd spend the whole night in the back of the car in their shift, and they let you out at 6 o'clock in the morning. But you'd tell them jokes and stuff, which was worked against you, because if they left, like a couple weeks later, two other cops, hey, you the guy that told the joke? Yeah, get in the back. Get in the back. Okay. Hey, well, tell my part of the joke about the guy with the thing. Oh, yeah, whatever it is. You know. So it was, to me, because, you know, at the time, the hot book was Ladies and Gentlemen, Lenny Bruce.
Right.
And Lenny Bruce had died a few years earlier.
66, I think. 66. Yeah.
And it seemed like strippers and comedy and the underbelly, the seedy underbelly of New York. It just seemed like the hippest, coolest place in the world to be. Yeah. I used to work Broadway Burlesque, which was a strip joint. And it was just the seediest place. And there used to be a stripper named Silver Moon who was a gymnast who had the most incredible body, and she would practice all day twirling six guns and all this kind of stuff. And, you think the guys will like this? I go, yeah, it really doesn't. They're not really doing that. And then I saw her 10 years later, and she looked 55 years old, you know, living on that stripper diet of Reese's peanut butter cups and pizza slices and grape juice. And it just... grape soda, just crazy.
Yeah.
It was just, but it seemed like a really romantic, cool, dark and underbelly kind of a lifestyle, which I like.
And it is kind of.
Yeah, it is. It is.
So when you go out now, like what do you, how many weeks are you out?
I do about 210 dates a year or something like that.
And do you write all your own shit still?
Yeah, for the most part. Sometimes people come up to you and give you something.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Pay them?
Yeah, you pay them.
Yeah.
You know, I had somebody give me a great joke.
Oh, yeah.
And I did it like three or four times. And then this is why you got to watch everybody. I watched Jim Jeffries and I go, fuck that. That's his joke.
Oh, someone gave you Jim Jeffries.
You know,
joke.
And I called him up and I said, look, man, I did this joke two times, once in Vegas. I had no idea. Oh, that's cool, man. I said, look, it'll never happen again. I mean, I just felt so bad.
Yeah.
So now I just, it's just from guys I know and or girls I know, whoever I know.
Are people that, you still work with guys that wrote for you for years sometimes?
Once in a while, guys send you something.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's fun.
So 200, so and what do you go regular down to the Comedy Magic Club in Hermosa?
Been to the Comedy Magic Club every Sunday since 78.
Yeah, and that's still ongoing.
Yeah, I mean, that's the only... You know, for some reason, people find this fascinating. I always live on the money I made at a stand-up. I never touched a dime.
Well, what are you going to do with the other money?
Tonight Show. I do a lot of, I got philanthropic stuff.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You make enough. It's my wife and I, please. I mean, it's not like I get,
right.
You know, we've got some scholarships. My wife works women of Afghanistan, you know, she's with the feminist majority, and they try to, they smuggle girls out and they give them educations here in America. And I mean, it's really satisfying. You meet these girls, and now they're 10 years later, they're women and they're doctors and they're lawyers. And
it's beautiful.
And you know, it's really cool. Yeah. It's really cool. And I, to me, I love being a comic. To me, it's the greatest job in show business. Yeah. You don't, you know, I have, if the gig's at 8 o'clock, your plane lands at 7:15, you're at the club at 7:45, and you go, fuck, I got to kill 15 minutes. Yeah. You know, everybody else, they got to bring the Teamsters, unload. You sound check. Yeah, the bass player's drunk again. Oh, see another bass player. See if we can find somebody. You know, I don't, you don't have any of those problems.
Yeah.
You write joke, tell joke, get check. Yeah. It's real simple.
Get laugh, then get check?
Yeah.
Or not go back.
But you know, it's so much fun just to craft a joke on the road.
Yeah.
You know, I was trying to come up with something with the school shootings. You know? I'm thinking, how do you do a joke about that?
Right.
Let's see if you like this one.
Okay.
You know, Trump said he wants to arm the teachers. Have they thought this through? Like the school librarian, would her gun have to have a silencer? Like, shh, poof, shh, poof, poof, shh, poof. You know, just.
And did that work?
It works, actually. And I always say to the audience, you're laughing at school shooting. You know how hard it is to write a school shooting joke?
Yeah.
But there's a great sense of accomplishment when you have a joke that's actually...
Oh, yeah, when you're challenged by the...
I mean, to me, I will do an hour...
Horror just, of the news.
Yeah, just to try out one line. You know?
So it's still pretty topical? So your turnover is pretty...
No, it's what you call evergreen topical. Because most people don't know anything. I learned on The Tonight Show, once you get past Secretary of State, nobody has any idea who you're talking about. They just don't know anything.
It's sad, isn't
it? So you have to talk about, how about the economy?
Yeah, yeah.
And Congress, you know, because on The Tonight Show, a joke that killed on Monday by Friday, who was that again? That was, you know.
Oh, and now it's got to be so exhausting. Just like, it's just a, it's a dump truck full of shit every day.
Yeah, and you know, to me, it's funny because back, I did it when Bush was dumb and Clinton was horny, and it was just easier. You know, comedy comes from a certain conservative place, and then it's outrageous when you cross the line. But when the president's banging hookers and saying Africa's a shithole, where do you go? Where do you, how do you make that funnier?
Yeah.
What's, how do you exaggerate
well,
that?
Well, now it's like sort of on these guys, you know, like it's sort of impressive, like Kimmel and Colbert.
You know,
they, they've got to hold the line.
Kimmel, Colbert. They're
actually serving as a check on the executive power.
Yeah, Samantha Bee.
Yeah, sure.
Trevor. Jimmy
and now,
also
and
Fallon.
Now Michelle.
Yeah, Michelle will. I mean, I
Jimmy
think
it, came around.
Yeah, I think it's well. You know, I you can't blame Jimmy.
I don't blame him
because it's the Tonight Show. It's the mainstream show.
Yeah, no, I like it. I like going on with him. I like going on with all the guys.
Yeah, really. I mean, it's tough to write a different version of the same joke every night.
Everyone, there's
and
so many
and I don't
places.
Say that insultingly. Yeah. I mean, it's just basically. What did Trump do? What?
Right. And you got, in every one of the shows, it's got a dozen guys sitting there churning out monologue jokes.
Yeah.
You're going down the, like, you know.
Yeah. And like now, when you go on the road, if people don't like your politics, they don't like your act. I mean, that's why I really enjoyed Seinfeld's last Netflix special. Because
it's just with him going over his old bits.
Yeah. Here's a bunch of jokes.
Yeah.
Here's a bunch of jokes. Oh, thank you. I don't have to commit to a point of view.
Yeah.
I don't have to tell you my opinion. I just here to laugh, you know.
Yeah. I don't know what's going on inside that guy.
With Jerry?
Yeah. I mean, I get more of an, I get a sense of you, but like, because like, his point of view is very specifically mundane, just sort of elaborating on you know, these little things, but like, I don't know what that guy is. There's one moment when, on Comedians in Cars, when Shanling's with him.
Yeah.
And Shanling says to him, they obviously love each other, and Shanling says, you seem very angry. And there is a moment on Seinfeld's face where I'm like, oh, that's what it is.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean. I know what you mean. Yeah, but you know, Seinfeld and I, when we talk on the phone, we each come away with something funny.
Oh, yeah, I bet. I bet. You guys are
it's
real
just,
joke guys.
It really makes me laugh.
You talk to him often?
And I always, I talk to him a lot. I always try to find the thing that makes... Oh, we were talking about, and this is not, Tig Notaro.
Yeah, Tig Notaro, yeah.
How do you say her name?
Notaro.
Notaro, I'm sorry. And I said, I thought she's funny. I said, I don't know how she'd do in Vegas at the Sand and Gravel Convention, but I think, you know, it's a point of view. And you realize comic is very specific now for specific audiences. You know, we're sort of the old school, you try to work every crowd. You know, I once booked myself into Oral Roberts University. I just want to see if I could play this. See what they like.
Yeah.
And all they said was, no sex jokes. You can do anything else. Please don't do any sex jokes. okay, I signed a contract, I got paid, I went to it. And, you know, they were fine. Yeah. I mean, politics, everything else, just like anybody else. They just don't want any dick jokes. They don't want any, you know, it's all right.
So. Well, I remember when I interviewed Gallagher years ago and he walked out on me, like, he before he walked out, when we were having a reasonable conversation, he was talking about these people who come up on stage with their notebooks. You can't bring your notebook on stage if you're playing the state fair in Oklahoma or wherever it was. Like, he was just making this point about, like, how, don't you want to play a state fair? And then you have that moment where you're like, no, I don't want to play a state fair.
Gallagher, you know, Gallagher ran for governor.
Yeah, here?
Yeah. And when that whole thing was going on, remember there was some stripper running when Schwarzenegger was. So we had all 50 candidates on.
Yeah.
The strippers. So, and Gallagher, who was a good. And Gallagher comes up and he goes, you know, you got to put me on and talk. I can't because it's equal time.
Yeah.
And he was so mad at me. He goes, I can't because legally, if I give you 5 minutes, we had all 50 candidates in the audience all answering the question at the same time, all just talking.
All right. It's a bit.
Yeah, a bit. And Gallagher, no, let me talk. No, and I said, I can't. Don't you understand? And he hadn't spoken to me since.
Did he walk out? Yeah, boy. Your life is like a lot. I bet that's a real hit to take. Gallagher, not going to talk to you anymore.
Well, but you know something? Good comic back in the day.
Was he?
Really good, yeah. He had.
Before the props? It was always props.
There were always props, but he always had funny stuff. Uh-huh. I mean, it was.
Yeah.
You know, that everybody has that flash of brilliance. I don't know. And things happen along the way. Sometimes it's drugs. Sometimes it's relationships. Sometimes it's you're too straight. You're too gay. You're too screwed up. But that initial, you know, that's what I, like when I watch Michelle Wolf now, I'm seeing the prime. I'm seeing her really burning white hot.
Yeah.
And she has such fun doing it. I love watching a comedian who enjoys performing because she's got that big smile and Nixon's so-and-so's an asshole.
Yeah.
You know, and she's laughing at her own joke but in a good way.
Yeah.
And I love to watch the joy of comics performing. I hate when people, oh man, this sucks.
Well, that was the great thing about being at the store. It's like on any given night, you could just sit there, you know, and watch people. You worked there.
I remember Newhart came in one night to see, I'm not going to say who it was, there was a comedian who was a hot comedian.
Yeah.
Newhart's sitting there. And they go, please welcome so-and-so. And the guy comes up, how you doing? Hey, where you from? Denver. Fuck Denver. Huge laugh. And Bob goes, I don't get it. And he says, where you from? Boston. Fuck Boston. Woo! Woo! And Bob goes, I don't get it. Why is this a joke? I mean, it just really made me. He was one of Bob Newhart. Nobody
he's so
funny.
Good. He's so great.
You know what it is? He's like Letterman. He has that word.
Yeah.
He has a bit. It's so subtle.
Yeah.
It just killed me. I watched him one time. He used to do it about the first astronaut to have extraterrestrial interaction in space.
Yeah.
Okay. So he's met the aliens and he's having a press conference and he's talking about it, you know. And a reporter says to him, how far ahead of us are these aliens? And Newhart says, about 6 weeks. And you go, it's 6 weeks. You know, 2 weeks you can catch up to. 6 months is too far away. But 6 weeks is just enough that we'll never catch them. They'll always be just 6 weeks. And you know something? It was such a subtle Bob Newhart, just a throwaway line.
Yeah.
It was as light as a feather, and it stayed in the air.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it, to me, I love watching when comics can do that. You know how I used
great
to like...
He's got such a unique timing.
Bob and Ray.
You know,
they had that sense of...
Right.
You know, I remember they used to have a bit about some guy wrote a book on the presidents, and they were checking it for accuracy, and they said, now here you have a picture of Lincoln riding his inauguration in an automobile. Well, don't worry about that. Well, they didn't have automobile. You know, and they just have this goes off on a tangent.
The
just
build.
As, you know, I always like the disappearing dime trick more than the huge illusion. Because the disappearing dime trick, it's right in front of you, and he's using his hands, you know. And when people can use words that way, like it's like Newhart, just talking, you know.
Yeah.
No funny costume, no funny face.
Yeah.
Just throw the word out there.
And he's a great reactor. And
great
he can
reactor.
React to himself.
Oh,
like
fantastic.
That weird beat that he takes. Is
really funny.
It really is, man. All right, buddy. Well, that was great. I think that we had a good talk.
That good for you?
Yeah, was it good for you? You feel better?
Yeah. Yeah. It's good.
I always like you, Jay. I know.
I always liked you. I thought you were funny.
Did you ever resolve anything with Conan, or is that just shit?
No, I have no. You know something? I don't know.
Yeah.
To me, this is business.
Right.
Do you really get screwed by another performer? I mean, was I supposed to quit?
Yeah.
You know, one day I was in traffic, and I pull away, and this guy goes, beep! And he pulls up next to me, and I go, I'm sorry, man. I didn't mean to cut you off. I looked in my rearview mirror. I didn't see you. You didn't cut me off. What's the problem? You stole Conan's dream, man. And he starts screaming at me, and I go, what are you... I said, you want to pull over and talk about this? No, I don't, man. But you stole Conan's dream. And he's just screaming. I go, okay. You want to pull over, have a cup of coffee, and we talk? No, I'm not talking to you. And he took off. I went, all right. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what that was. And to me, it's a business decision, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when they had the strike at the Comedy Store, there was a group of people that wanted all comics to get paid the same on gigs, no matter what your talent. Well, it doesn't work that way.
Right.
It's a competitive society. The guy hits the most home runs gets the biggest contract. I mean, what are you doing?
What'd you do on the strike? Were you on either side, or were you?
No, I was with the comics.
Yeah.
I don't want to say it was. I mean, I remember asking. I think $25 seemed fair.
Yeah.
And
for as opposed to not getting paid at all.
Not getting paid at all. Just $25
is
sad.
Yeah.
And Mitzi was so opposed. This was such a huge insult. And I think she was insulted. And it wasn't about the money. It was about the fact that this is a school where you learn.
Right.
But she
Someone's
was making
money. Yeah.
I mean, you had the Comedy Store, this Comedy Store South, the Comedy Store West and Westwood, the comedy. There were comedy stores all over the place, and they were doing huge business, and they were the talk of, you know, Johnny Carr. My next act comes from the Comedy Store right here down in Los Angeles. You know, it was the perfect name, Comedy Store. Go there, buy comedy. Buses would pull up. I mean, making millions of dollars, and it didn't seem that outrageous to get $25, but the door was so slammed in our face, it really was, you know.
Yeah, it seemed weird.
Yeah, and it was weird. And I always, because I always liked Mitzi, she was always good to me, but she just couldn't let her comics go off. You know, the old, if you love it, set it free.
Yeah,
you know, that silly thing.
Or just work down the street, for fuck's sake. You
know
what I mean?
Exactly.
Yeah, it's on fire again, dude. It's like crazy. Like, it's crazy busy there.
Good.
You should go over there, do a set, see what happens.
Yeah, it'd be fun to do a set. I've worked the Laugh Factory a couple of times. I like that. That's true.
And where'd you work? You worked all the rooms at the store, main room?
I worked all the rooms, yeah. It was fun.
Yeah. Do you ever miss those times?
I miss the camaraderie. That's what I think that TV show doesn't capture. It doesn't capture the real fun of it. And, you know, the funniest thing about the TV show, there's nothing harder than writing a joke.
Yeah.
You can write all the dramatic scenes you want. And to me, that show should be filled with jokes.
Right.
Just constantly jokes.
Great jokes.
You know, the great thing about the old Dick Van Dyke show was they could do the bad jokes in the writer's room.
Yeah.
And then, how about this? You know, and it wasn't, and you knew it wasn't funny, but it was funny that they threw it out. You know?
Yeah.
And that's what that show should have, just the bad jokes as well, you know?
Right, but the good jokes should be the actual show.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. I don't know, like, you know, like I have a weird history with that place, and it doesn't go back that far, but it's the only place in town I'll work because I love it, you know, and now it's like, it's since we all got sort of behind it on social media, you know, they put some money into security and did new bathrooms, and like, you know, it's a real well-managed joint now.
Oh, good,
great,
good.
You know? A lot of people are coming out that weren't there before, that never really worked there. I think Jerry did the first set he'd ever done, maybe done one other one there.
Mitzi didn't like Jerry.
Yeah?
She
I wonder why
couldn't
is that
go.
Is.
I think he was seen as an improv act. He was an improv comic.
You think that was it?
I think that might have been it. Plus, Jerry has always been his own man and does his own way. And if Mitzi ever said, Jerry, I think you should do it this way. No. You know, Jerry's not a guy that's going to go,
right.
Oh, okay, let me think about it. And then, you know, me, I would go, oh, well, thank you. That's a good suggestion. Fuck that, you know. And then I would just do what I, but, you know, Jerry just kind of, no, that's not going to happen.
Right.
And I think she resented the fact that he was he came out a fully formed comic.
Yeah.
So she couldn't mold him in any sense.
Yeah.
You know, most of the other comics are just, well, what's this?
Lost people. Lost souls.
Yeah, lost souls.
Yeah,
souls. That's why I like them all. You know, even the comics that I supposedly don't like me. I still like them because they're the only other people that have this. You have a shared experience.
Yeah.
It's like guys, you're in battle together or something. You're in war together.
Sure.
You know what it's like. You got shot at.
Who are your friends? Do you hang out with people? Like comics or
I
mostly?
I see Jerry.
Yeah.
Brogan and I work together all the time.
Oh, yeah, Jimmy.
I was at Comedy Magic. Billy Gardell. I like.
Oh, yeah,
I work with
nice
a lot
guy.
Of...
Nice yeah.
guy.
Yeah,
great guy.
Yeah.
Really funny guy.
Yeah.
Just,
yeah.
I like... meeting new comics, it's just funny to me. I see a lot of guys that are really, really good.
Yeah.
And it's fun to see female comics now. I mean, I think it's, I don't know if it's totally equal, but it seems really damn close at this point.
Yeah, a lot of people coming in. There's a lot of, it just seems like a lot of people are getting into it.
You know, Ellen DeGeneres was the first one for me that, she didn't do a male or female act. She was just a comedian. I hate comedian. I hate that name. You're a comedian.
You're a comic, okay? Yeah.
I mean, Ellen has bits I wish I had and I'd love to do.
Yeah.
And maybe she thinks that I have something she'd like. But you could do that. It's not gender specific. It's not
right.
The old toady feel. Sure. You like this dress? You know, that kind of, you know.
Yeah. Show business. Good seeing you, Jay.
You too.
Thanks, man.
Thanks.
All right. Well, I thought we covered it. It was great to see him. You know, he's Jay Leno, and he's a great comic, and we talked about the stuff. Okay, we talked about it, and I feel good about it. And as he was leaving, he says, "Let me know. You know, anytime you want me to come back, I'll come back. Anytime you want me to come back." And while you're still listening to the end of this show, go check out our new WTF t-shirts at podswag.com/WTF or the merch page at WTFpod.com. And know that, but I really love the multicolor 3D one. So go get one. You can wear it and have people ask, what is that thing? And as a WTF then, you'll know. It's the old logo. Trippy, man. We also might be getting another one. I got Aaron Draplin involved. The fucking genius. The logo genius, Aaron Draplin, is coming up with a very spectacular shirt that I think we might premiere soon. Okay? All right? I just got a whole shit ton of my V-picks. V-picks, I freaked out because I now use a very specific and fat pick. It's the Ed King signature pick. That like I got from VPix. Now Ed King is the original guitar player for Lynyrd Skynyrd, one of them, right? And I don't know. You used to order them from VPix, and you get a card signed by Ed King, and these picks. Apparently, he used to play with a shell, so they fashioned this like it's got to be a millimeter thick at least, or a millimeter and a half thick, with this sort of sanded edge to it. A giant triangular pick, and I started playing with them. They're hard as fuck. And I can't not have them now. And I just got a bag of them from Vinny over at VPix because they said they were sold out on the site. So I had to email directly and he got a hold of me and, you know, he made it happen, man. So I just got to give him some props for that. If you want to check out, if you're a guitar player, you can go to v-picks.com. And they got a lot of weird picks, but I used the red transparent Ed King signature pick with the sanded edges. And I'm going to play some guitar right now because that's what I do now.
Bridget Jones.
Bridget ist zurück.
Hattest du Sex?
Bridget Jones. Verrückt nach ihm. Jetzt zu Hause erleben, kaufen oder leihen. Erhältlich bei Amazon Prime Video, Apple TV und im Sky Store. Auch im Kino.
Ja, ich hatte Sex. Und es war fantastisch.